Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. May is Mental Health Month, and I'd like to begin this show with some basic mental health facts. Almost 44 million adults experience mental illness in any given year. One in five adults in America experience a mental illness. Nearly 1 in 25, or about 10 million adults in America, live with a serious mental illness. One half of all chronic mental illness begins by the age of 14, three quarters by the age of 24. 1 in 100, or about 2.4 million American adults, live with schizophrenia. 2.6%, or 6.1 million of American adults, live with bipolar disease. 6.9%, or about 16 million American adults, live with major depression. And 18.1%, or 42 million American adults, live with one of a variety of anxiety disorders. 10.2 million adults have co-occurring mental health and addiction disorders. 26% of those that are homeless and are staying in shelters live with serious mental illness. Approximately 24% of state prisoners have a recent history of a mental health condition. Depression is the leading cause of disability worldwide and is a major contributor to the global burden of disease. In the U.S., serious mental illness costs $193 billion in lost earnings every year. 90% of those who die by suicide have an underlying mental illness. Suicide is the 10th leading cause of death in the U.S. Nearly 60% of adults with a mental illness didn't receive mental health services in the previous year. African American and Hispanic Americans use mental health services at about one-half the rate of whites, and Asian Americans at about one-third the rate. While tens of millions of Americans have to deal with diagnosable mental illnesses, everyone can benefit from building mental wellness and mental and emotional resiliency. From mentalhealthamerica.net, I want to talk about one of those aspects, which is social connections and recreation. Loneliness is bad for your health. Poor social supports make it harder to recover from mental illnesses, while a strong social support system improves overall outcomes and the ability to bounce back from stress. Strong interaction and recreation are all around good for you. People with strong social relationships are 50% more likely to live longer. People who do things in nature have better perceptions of their own emotional well-being. Adolescents who participate in sports have lower odds of suffering from depression or thinking about suicide, likely because sports increase self-esteem and social support. And considerations for caregivers, feelings of loneliness and isolation are common among caregivers. Adult daycare and other respite programs can help reduce the demands on caregivers, which may improve morale and allow more time for social and recreational activities. Moving to work-life balance, work allows you to provide for yourself and your family while also serving a purpose in the community. But when it takes over your life, it can negatively affect your health. Work-life balance is important. Of adults employed full-time in the U.S., Nearly 40% report working at least 50 hours per week, and 18% report working 60 hours or more each week. People who feel they have a good work-life balance are more satisfied with their job and their life and experience fewer symptoms of depression and anxiety. More than half of people who responded to Mental Health America's Work Health Survey say that they do unhealthy things such as drinking, drug use, or lashing out at others to cope with workplace stress. Over 75% of people are afraid of getting punished for taking a day off to attend to their mental health. More than two-thirds of people have had their sleep negatively affected by workplace issues. Poor work-life balance increases your risk for health conditions like sleep problems, digestive disorders, and mental health problems. This is especially true for people who work longer shifts or on nights and weekends. Working overtime increases the likelihood of having symptoms of depression, especially among men. And lastly, I want to cover a little topic from Mental Health America, humor. Finding humor in the circumstances of life can lift moods with laughter and help people to better deal with and overcome difficult experiences. What happens to our bodies when we laugh? Levels of stress hormones decrease. Your heart, lungs, and muscles are stimulated. There is increased activity in parts of the brain's reward system. And endorphins, the body's natural pain blockers, are released. Incorporating humor into your daily life has many potential benefits. A stronger immune system, improved mood and anxiety relief, better interactions with others, and less burnout on the job. Stress and the hormones it produces can do a lot of damage to the mind and body over time. Since humor and laughter reduce the amounts of these hormones, it has also been shown that they can help reduce the risk of blood clots, heart conditions, and other stress-related diseases. One thing that's often overlooked in our physical and mental health is good sleep. And this article from Science Daily, Common Sleep Myths Compromise Good Sleep and Health. People often say that they can get by on 5 or fewer hours of sleep, that snoring is harmless, and that having a drink helps you fall asleep. These are, in fact, among the most widely held myths about sleeping, and not only shape poor habits, but may also pose a significant public health threat. Sleep is a vital part of life that affects our productivity, mood, and general health and well-being. The claim by some people that they can get by on 5 hours of sleep was among the top myths researchers were able to dispel based on scientific evidence. They say this myth also poses the most serious risk to health from long-term sleep deficits. You can take naps when you routinely have difficulty sleeping overnight, create a consistent sleep schedule, and spend more time, at least 7 hours, asleep. Another common myth relates to snoring. Snoring can be harmless. It can also be a sign of sleep apnea, a potentially serious sleep disorder in which breathing starts and stops over the course of the night. Finally, despite beliefs to the contrary, drinking alcoholic beverages before bed is indeed unhealthy for sleep. Alcohol reduces the body's ability to achieve deep sleep, which people need to function properly. Okay, in another study, this from ScienceDaily.com, simple positive emotion skills yield benefits in physical and emotional health. This one's dealing specifically with caregivers. Caring for family members with dementia, which is on the rise in the U.S., causes significant emotional and physical stress that increases caregivers' risk of depression, anxiety, and death. A new method for coping with such stress by teaching people how to focus on positive emotions reduce their anxiety and depression after 6 weeks, reports a new national Northwestern Medicine study. It also resulted in better self-reported physical health and positive attitudes towards caregiving. The positive emotion intervention does not require a licensed therapist and can be widely implemented, making it accessible and affordable to busy caregivers. The intervention included 8 skills that evidence shows increase positive emotions. They include noticing and capitalizing on positive events, gratitude, mindfulness, positive reappraisal, personal strengths, attainable goals, and acts of kindness. In 6 weekly sessions, caregivers reviewed positive emotion skills and then had daily homework to practice the skills, including audio recordings. For instance, if the topic was acts of kindness, their homework was to go out and practice an act of kindness. The skills taught to participants in the study: 1. Recognizing a positive event each day. 2. Savoring that positive event and logging it in a journal to tell someone about it. 3. Starting a daily gratitude journal. 4. Listing a personal strength each day and noting how you used this strength recently. 5. Setting an attainable goal each day and noting your progress. 6. Reporting a relatively minor stressor each day, then listing ways in which the event can be positively reappraised or reframed. 7. Understanding small acts of kindness can have a big impact on positive emotion and practicing a small act of kindness each day. 8. Practicing mindfulness through paying attention to daily experiences and with a daily 10-minute breathing exercise, concentrating on the breath. I'll be talking more about mental health this month, so stay tuned. Now, on with the public health news and research roundup, where I review public health news and research for you so you don't have to.
Attention listeners, as per the WAKT Pro Bono Legal Department, please note that this public health news and research roundup has no affiliation with the herbicide Roundup, which is a registered trademark of Monsanto. Also, please note that, unlike the herbicide Roundup, this public health news and research Roundup is not a known human carcinogen.
First up, from consumeraffairs.com, in Monsanto's old backyard, a school district suspends Roundup. We're moving a lot of stuff to eco-friendly as a district, Nick Barral, the facilities manager for the Woodland Joint Unified School District, tells Consumer Affairs. Among the recent eco-friendly moves, in October of last year, Barral told parents that the school district had instructed its landscaper to indefinitely suspend the spraying of glyphosate, the key ingredient in Monsanto's Roundup and other weed killers. It was news that came in a particularly poetic time and place. For years, Monsanto had counted Woodland, an agricultural town in Northern California, as one of its largest homes in North America. Monsanto's vegetable seed research lab in Woodland is described by the company as the largest of its kind in the world. The timing of the school district's announcement was also important. Just 2 months prior, a former school groundskeeper named Dwayne Lee Johnson won a landmark $289 million verdict against Monsanto after convincing a jury that his regular application of Roundup caused him to develop non-Hodgkin lymphoma. He worked for a district that is located down the road from Woodland. Glyphosate was classified as probably carcinogenic to humans by the World Health Organization in March 2015. But federal regulators in the United States maintain that the chemical, which is the most widely used pesticide in the world, is safe. In March, city officials in Miami passed a law banning the city and its contractors from using herbicides that contain glyphosate, explaining that the volume sprayed on city parks and landscaping may contaminate the city's watershed. In Oakland, California, the Oakland Unified School District and the city itself both suddenly announced that they would quit spraying it. Earlier this month, the Los Angeles County Board of Supervisors banned glyphosate-based weed killers on county property, saying that there wasn't enough data available to prove that the products are safe. Most recently, two city council members in New York City introduced a proposal that would ban all city agencies from spraying glyphosate-based herbicides and other pesticides with potentially toxic chemicals in public places. To be sure, the biggest user of Roundup continues to be the agricultural industry, which uses the spray in conjunction with glyphosate-resistant soybeans under a business model that has made Monsanto and its competitors billions of dollars. Cutting glyphosate out of farming would require changes on a massive scale. But the use of Roundup by government agencies in parks and other spaces has also become a concern to environmentalists and people in public health policy. Non-agricultural uses of Roundup grew by 14% between 2005 and 2012. In the United States, 26 million pounds of Roundup are sprayed on public parks, playgrounds, schools, and gardens every year. Some community governments across the country, from Portland, Oregon to Charlottesville, Virginia, were already getting proactive about reducing their use of Roundup, absent of federal restrictions. Unfortunately, glyphosate is not the only dangerous chemical. It's a bit of a whack-a-mole. Monsanto is certainly the corporation everyone loves to hate, and I do, but I'm no fan of Dow Chemical either. One chemical gets banned, and often the substitute is worse than the original. In particular, she's worried about 2,4-D, a potent weed killer that is sometimes used as an alternative to glyphosate. And in more news from Monsanto-related, Bayer board in emergency meeting after investors rebuke CEO. Bayer AG's supervisory board called an emergency meeting on Friday after Chief Executive Officer Werner Baumann lost a crucial confidence vote as investors questioned his handling of the $63 billion Monsanto deal and the wave of U.S. lawsuits that followed. That looks like another headache for Bayer taking over Monsantoville. From Kaiser Health News, states weigh banning a widely used pesticide even though EPA won't. Lawmakers in several states are trying to ban a widely used pesticide that the Environmental Protection Agency is fighting to keep on the market. The pesticide, chlorpyrifos, kills insects on contact by attacking their nervous systems. Several studies have linked prenatal exposure of chlorpyrifos to lower birth weights, lower IQs, attention deficit disorder, and other developmental issues in children. Hawaii was the first state to pass a full ban last year. Now California, Oregon, New York, and Connecticut are trying to do the same. If California is successful, that's a big deal. It's such a big state, the biggest agricultural state. Next up from Scientific American, is the EPA stifling science on chemical toxicity reports? The Environmental Protection Agency is changing its approach to chemical toxicity oversight, according to a recent report issued by the Government Accountability Office. In the overhaul, the EPA reassigned staff from the Integrated Risk Information System, IRIS, a program that conducts comprehensive scientific reviews, to duties related to the Toxic Substances Control Act, which has a much narrower mandate. The agency has also reduced the number of its ongoing chemical toxicity assessments from 20 down to 3. Former EPA officials contend the shakeup takes chemical assessments out of the hands of career scientists, potentially to the detriment of public health. The EPA also recently halted release of a long-awaited formaldehyde toxicity assessment. An EPA official who spoke on the condition of anonymity due to not being authorized to talk to the media says, "The Integrated Risk Information System and the Toxic Substance Control Act are very different in their approaches to chemical safety regulation. One could make the argument that this is political interference, in that high-level people are saying which methodology we should use to assess the safety of a chemical, and the policy is pretty clear that they're not supposed to do that." Gina Reed, a science and policy analyst at the Union of Concerned Scientists, says the Toxic Substances and Control Act has become politicized, and that shifting integrated risk information system scientists to a more political process to look at these chemicals is undermining the work of EPA's own scientists. "I really see this as a part of restructuring of EPA in such a way that science will have very little to do with what EPA is basing its regulation on, and that will end up with much weaker regulations in terms of protecting the public health." And a related note, from a July 2018 email to Monsanto, a domestic policy advisor at the White House said, quote, "We have Monsanto's back on pesticides regulations. Monsanto need not fear any additional regulation from this administration," end of quote. Enough said. Continuing with this theme, from Scientific American, as pesticide turns up in more places, safety concerns mount. For decades, Judy Hoy has run an independent wildlife rehabilitation center from her Montana home, where she also previously performed autopsies on deer struck by cars. In the late 1990s, she noticed a bizarre trend. Many deer had pronounced overbites, enlarged right heart ventricles, and damaged or missing thymus glands and scrota. And the deer were not alone. We were seeing those same big birth defects on all of the big game and domestic animals. She suspected a new class of pesticides called neonicotinoids might be responsible. Neonicotinoids, which target insects' nervous systems with lethal efficiency, were developed by Bayer in the 1980s as a safer alternative to existing pesticides. They are considered less toxic to vertebrates, and rather than being broadly sprayed over fields, they can be applied directly to seeds or delivered via irrigation and incorporated into tissues as the plant develops, in theory minimizing their chances of spreading into the environment. But a growing body of research is challenging that paradigm, pointing to toxic impacts on non-pest species from bees to deer and to transmission beyond farm fields. Only 2 to 20% of the neonicotinoids applied to seeds make it into the plant. That begs the question of where the other 80 to 98% of the chemicals are going. And we're starting to find them in other areas of the environment. We're finding them in surface waters. We're finding them in untreated plants. 90% of corn and 50% of soybeans in the United States are treated with neonicotinoids. The chemicals are designed to diminish in treated plants over time, but their half-life runs up to 1,400 days, meaning annual applications to crops could be causing neonicotinoids to accumulate in the environment. The pesticides are also water-soluble, which is why they can be delivered to growing plants via irrigation, but also means runoff can carry them to lakes and rivers. These chemicals are getting into the broader food chain, and they are not toxic to many species. Other studies have begun detecting neonicotinoids in wild birds of prey, rodents, fish, lizards, and frogs. Neonicotinoids are also turning up in human food, but the extent of these pesticides' toxicity to humans is not yet clear to scientists. The problem is not as simple as banning one pesticide or another, though. The bigger problem is that we become complacent about using pesticides for everything. Alternatives such as regenerative agriculture, promotes biodiversity to help control pests with beneficial insects, are already available and are scalable to commercial farming. But he adds that meaningful change will have to come from grassroots efforts. I think these sorts of paradigm shifts throughout history don't necessarily come from the government or the university. They come from the people on the ground who decide to make change. Within our food system, who needs to make that change? The farmers do, the beekeepers do, the consumers do. They need to demand something better. Continuing on the environmental theme, from nutritionfacts.org, are microplastics in seafood a cancer risk? Plastic debris in the sea is more than just an unsightly problem. The concern is not so much discarded bobbing bottles as teeny microplastic particles, raising questions about cancer. Wait, what does plastic have to do with cancer? Back in the 1950s, researchers had observed that when they wrapped the kidneys of rats with cellophane to cause high blood pressure, they ended up inadvertently causing cancer. Cancers had started growing around the cellophane. So they tried slipping all sorts of different plastics under the skin of rodents, and they all produce malignant tumors. And then if you feed rats some plastic microbeads, up to 6% of the particles end up in their bloodstream within 15 minutes. So could all this microplastics pollution be one of the reasons we're seeing an increased number of tumors found in wildlife? Perhaps a global increase in wildlife cancers should be a wake-up call. Now, we don't know if it's the plastic itself or some of the chemical additives like BPA that are to blame. Maybe just having plastic particles stuck in your body causes some sort of mechanical irritation beyond the chemical impact of the plastics as carriers of possible carcinogens. Some plastics may be cancer-causing in and of themselves, but all plastics readily accumulate harmful chemicals, such as persistent pesticides like DDT, PCBs, flame retardant chemicals, increasing their concentration by orders of magnitude. This process is then reversible, with microplastics releasing contaminants upon ingestion. So plastic debris may act as a vector, transferring persistent, bioaccumulative, and toxic substances from the water to the food. Plastics are known to concentrate pollution from water by factors of up to 1 million times, for example, for PCBs. In fact, that's one of the ways environmental scientists sample for contamination levels. They use plastic to sponge up pollutants. The concern, then, is that the plastic takes up all these toxins and then goes and deposits them into the aquatic food chain, where they can climb up the food chain and ultimately into humans. The longer you feed polluted microbeads to fish, the higher the levels of fish flesh contamination. So you can see how pollutant levels can then concentrate up the food chain with maximum exposure in the apex predators like killer whales or people. We know that in the U.S., of all food categories, fish has the highest levels of PCBs, dioxins, and other pollutants. Well, it's hard to come up with a tolerable daily intake to these kind of chemicals, but the World Health Organization recommends staying under like 1 to 4 units a day, measured as picograms of toxic equivalents. The European Union came up with a smaller number, like no more than 2 a day on average, and in the U.S. we're already past that. So there is some concern for toxicity for PCBs, given the current levels of PCBs and plastic debris polluting the ocean. There's no room for additional PCB body burden. Dun, 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 dun. Okay, switching gears a bit, this from the Columbus Dispatch. Ohio ranks 47th in federal public health dollars per person. Ohio is 47th among states when it comes to public health funding received from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, a new report found. Ohio also ranks poorly, 46th, in a separate analysis of public health funding at the state level. It is important to remember, however, that much of Ohio's public health funding is generated at the local level. Local health departments get about 75% of funding from local communities through a combination of licensing and other fees, property taxes, and/or tax levies. The rest comes from the Ohio Department of Health's budget, the bulk of it originating from federal dollars and a tiny percent from state funds. And from NPR, opioid addiction drug goes mostly to whites, even as black death rates rise. Buprenorphine, better known as by the brand name Suboxone, helps people with opioid addiction stay in recovery, but it is prescribed far more often in white drug users than to blacks. White drug users addicted to heroin, fentanyl, and other opioids have had near exclusive access to Suboxone, a drug that curbs the craving for opioids and reduces the chance for a fatal overdose. White populations are almost 35 times as likely to have a Suboxone-related visit than black Americans. The dominant use of Suboxone to treat whites occurred at the same time opioid overdose deaths were rising faster for blacks than for whites. This epidemic over the last few years has been framed by many as largely a white epidemic, but we know now that's not true. Some physicians who have studied racial disparities in addiction treatment say the root causes go back to 2000 when Suboxone was approved. At that time, proponents argued that Suboxone was needed to help treat suburban youth. Those young patients didn't see themselves as addicted to heroin in the same way as hardcore urban heroin users who went to methadone clinics for treatment. Suboxone was introduced as private office treatment for a private market with the means to pay. So the unequal dissemination of Suboxone for opioid dependence is not accidental. The fix must include universal access to treatment in a primary care settings and end to the criminalization of opioid dependence, which puts more blacks in prison for drug use than whites, and more federal funding to expand access to Suboxone for all patients. Fewer than half of Americans with an opioid use disorder have access to Suboxone or the other two medications used to treat opioid addiction. Drug makers will soon have to include prices in TV ads as soon as this summer. This from Stat News. It's official. The Trump administration will begin requiring drug makers to include their sticker prices in TV ads, and those updates could hit the airwaves as soon as this summer. It will apply to any drug that costs more than $35 for a month's supply. Department of Health and Human Services can't force drug makers to comply with the regulation. Instead, it's depending on drug makers to sue each other over so-called deceptive trade practices to enforce the rule. Well, that's interesting enough. Well, you know, this is fine, this transparency of drug prices. You know, I'm not going to argue with this fine idea. However, it's very limited. Drug pricing and the way prescription drugs are purchased is unlike most products we buy. Patients rely on expert opinions for physicians, and it's unreasonable to expect that patients are going to make better decisions than their physicians. Also, it requires cheaper alternatives to actually be available with similar or better effectiveness. And price in healthcare often has little to do with the decision to use prescription meds, because insurance pays most of the costs and the patient's copays are often fixed, so it doesn't matter which drug you're using. And switching to another part of the drug price issue, from Mother Jones magazine, this is why your drug prescriptions cost so damn much. When the Republican-controlled Congress approved a landmark program in 2003 to help seniors buy prescription drugs, it slapped on an unusual restriction. The federal government was barred from negotiating cheaper prices for those medicines. Instead, the job of holding down costs was outsourced to the insurance companies delivering the subsidized new coverage known as Medicare Part D. 93% of Democrats and 74% of Republicans favor letting the government negotiate Part D prescription drug prices. It's Exhibit A in how crony capitalism works, says Representative Peter Welch, Democrat from Vermont, who has sponsored or co-sponsored at least six bills since 2007 to allow Part D drug price negotiations. I mean, how in the world can one explain that the government actually passed a law saying you can't negotiate drug prices? Well, campaign contributions and lobbying obviously had a big part in making that upside-down outcome occur. Part D is expected to spend $103 billion to serve an estimated 43 million Americans. Part D accounts for nearly 30% of the nation's spending on prescription drugs. What's more, Part D often pays far more for drugs than do Medicare or the Veterans Health Administration, which, unlike Part D, mandate government measures to hold down prices. One report found that Part D pays 80% more for medicines than the VHA, the Veterans Health Administration, and 73% more than Medicaid.
And now, a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you suffer from moderate to severe disenchantment from rampant capitalism running the lives of you and your loved ones? From daily sexism that can't be mansplained away, from endemic racism that nobody seems to see, try Eliminol. It's the blue pill from Placebo Pharmaceutical Corporation. It's everything you think it is. The blue pill is a choice you'll never need to feel bad about ever again. Warning, use of Eliminol may lead to addiction in conjunction with a profound sense of not caring that you are addicted. Or caring for much of anything else at all, for that matter. If you have any residual concerns, call our lifelong customer hotline, 1-800-CALLUS. Call us whenever, callous always. We now return you to your regular programming, bringing you non-commercial radio, featuring locally produced content and fresh perspectives from non-corporate persons. Good luck with that.
Well, perhaps we can only handle so much non-commercial radio in any given day. So we're going to call it quits for today. If you would like to listen to this show at any time, you can find it online, this show and all previous shows, from toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Again, that's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me. My second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible, but in the end, they always fall. Always. And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some-